You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 125 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And we have peaked as a podcast. At least our spinoff, Talking Taco Time.
Talking Taco Time has peaked as a podcast. Pelton Cast has yet to peak yet.
Maybe it peaked a long time ago, actually.
Oh, yeah. We peaked years ago. The Seahawks did win the Super Bowl during the era.
True.
Yeah.
What we're referring to, if you haven't listened to it already, is our interview with the co-president of Taco Time Northwest, Robbie Tonkin. Amazing.
Stop everything you're doing right now if you haven't listened to it. Take the crisp burrito out of your mouth and go and listen to Talkin' Taco Time with Robbie Tonkin.
I mean, I actually might not suggest that because that's not as time sensitive as this podcast is. So maybe you should keep listening to this one and then go listen to Talkin' Taco Time. But it was pretty amazing. He told us about items that are coming back to the menu soon. He told us about a menu that could come to the menu inspired by Talkin' Taco Time.
If we get an item on the Taco Time menu, I mean, full page ad, right? When we're sitting there eating, can we say what the item is? Or are we teasing it?
No, yeah, you gotta listen to the pod.
When we're sitting there eating that item, we're going to know that we'll have been the ones to have started that.
So we're not the ones to have started this. We did break the news back in the day. Did not get aggregated. But speaking of Taco Time Northwest, and another friend of ours, Lil Woody's, they have finally merged together. Not perhaps in an official business relationship at this point. But
yet, I mean,
we'll see.
When Talkin' Taco Time gets involved with these two organizations, things happen.
But Lil Woody's Fast Food Month, this week's item, crisp chicken and beef burritos plus Mexi fries. How amazing is this?
It's amazing.
Thanks. Thanks for the insight there.
I thought you were going to ask for what I thought about the items themselves. No, you just wanted me to talk about them in theory.
All right, you could go into that.
Okay, so specifically, wanted to talk about the items and how they relate to the actual Taco Time items.
Okay.
Now, I preface this by saying Taco Time has been making Mexi fries and crisp burritos, crisp beef burritos for the last 50 years, crisp chicken burritos since Jake One stepped foot inside of a Taco Time, as confirmed by Robbie Tonkin, sort of.
Sort of.
As mildly confirmed by Robbie Tonkin.
It's not disproven by Robbie Tonkin.
It's like Jake One has winning the Grammy, number one, that he finally won. Number two, being sort of confirmed by Robbie Tonkin that he invented the crisp chicken burrito.
Yeah, that checks out.
So to preface this, Taco Time has been making these items for decades, right? Lil Woody's has been making these items for
days.
Yeah, once ever. So Lil Woody's is still kind of figuring it out, but we were there on the first day that they presumably were ever making these Taco Time inspired tacos, the little crispy. And I thought it was an amazing job of replicating what they're doing. And I think maybe the crisp beef might have even been better than the crisp beef burrito from Taco Time.
Wow. I mean, they're not an exact facsimile, but they're a pretty close replication and high quality. So if you go in there, I didn't really quite get this until we ordered. You get two of them for $7, and you can either choose two of the same one or a chicken and a beef, which I would recommend, so you get the best of both worlds.
Yes.
And then an enormous, if you get the basket Mexi fries, so many Mexi fries.
I've rarely complained about food locations giving you too much food. Sometimes Lil Woody's is just too many fries. I'm like, this side of fries is gigantic.
We had some left over.
Well, that was the basket, which is even bigger. Like, they are meant, I think a basket of fries is meant to be shared among four people.
Get Mexi fries for the table.
I like that.
It's a thing.
So, I'm not the hugest crisp beef burrito fan, right? It's not something I would go to often. Crisp chicken, unbelievable.
You know, the crisp beef used to be my go-to. I don't know how often I've had the crisp chicken. I had it the other day, And it was really good. It was better than I remembered. So I may have to start incorporating that more often.
You had this at the Taco Time corporate offices.
That is accurate. they catered our interview.
It was pretty incredible.
It's the first time I've ever had that happen. But then I've not normally interviewed people from Taco Time.
It was really the most excited that anybody has ever been to see us.
That's probably accurate.
Usually it's a response of, oh, you're here.
Why are you late?
We were sort of on time.
Yeah.
But honestly, the thing that it made me think and realize is, you know, I wasn't able to get to Little Woody's for the Baconator style burger that they did and for the Sourdough Jack style burger that they did. I did have the Big Mac.
The Little Big Mac.
Little Big Mac. And the thing that struck me about the Little Big Mac is that it was almost exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest difference is like the beef at Little Woody's is very different from McDonald's style beef.
Yeah, but almost every element was so close. And granted, that's a burger place to a burger place, kind of apples to apples.
Right.
And this we're talking about a burger place to a taco place. So it's a little bit more difficult because it's outside of their level of expertise.
It's outside of their purview.
Yeah. But it honestly impressed me with what they do at Taco Time because it's unreplicable, the crisp chicken and beef taco. Like, these weren't exact facsimiles of the crisp chicken and beef tacos. These were a Little Woody's take on it, I think more so than I would say the Little Big Mac was. Because my review of the Little Big Mac was, I don't know if this is a thing that we needed. You know, like, I like that Little Woody's is doing it, and it's fun to do, and I liked eating it. But also, like, it just didn't taste that different than a Big Mac to me. This was, like, a completely different item, almost.
I'll agree with that. You know what was a very close facsimile is the hot sauce.
Oh, man, was that hot sauce good.
And also know that if you get there, you're just going to get it with your order of the little crispy or with the Mexi fries.
The hot sauce was really good. The Mexi fries tasted pretty similar. I think it's hard to get them to be as greasy as Taco Time is able to get their Mexi fries. But I think the flavor on it was very similar to a traditional Mexi fry.
But definitely go out and try this. And, you know, be sure to tag PeltonCast on Instagram if you're posting about sure. your...
Just tag PeltonCast on Instagram whenever.
Yeah, seems like a good idea. And of course, as usual, if for some reason you haven't, check out our Instagram for, I guess, the story. Did you save the story?
No, I didn't save the story. It's gone forever.
Yeah, you should have saved that.
I mean, I have the photos saved.
All right. Well, maybe we'll post that as a post as well. But we will be continuing to detail our experiences eating food in the city of Seattle.
There was a person who heard me on the Talkin' Taco Time podcast who tagged me in the Little Woody's post about the Little Crispy. And I was like, oh, I know. Did you also see, this came from our Instagram, I saw somebody, a person who we follow on Instagram, because the podcast follows back, and they were drinking from Fremont Brewing Company. Last week, we had the Field to Ferment Fresh Hop Ale. They were drinking one that's, I would describe, even more exclusive fresh hop-wise. And that is the Koichi Canyon Fresh Hop Ale. I saw that and I was like, stop everything. The crisp burrito fell out of my mouth. And I was like, we need to go right now. I'm always unsure how much to comment to people about things off from the podcast Instagram. But I wanted to comment to that person about how impressed I was that they were drinking it because it looked good.
All right, well, we'll have to check that out.
And it's not what we're going to be drinking today.
It is not, because it is officially fall.
Finally.
As of last week.
It's been fall in the minds of Targets since like mid-July.
I am no longer complaining about the fall beer creep. And it's time for some pumpkin beer. So this is the first one of the season for us.
I am holding the Imperial Pumpkin Porter from Epic Brewing in...
Salt Lake City?
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
Salt Lake City and Denver, Colorado.
Huh.
All right. Well, they own the Mountain Time Zone. Are those both in the Mountain Time Zone?
Yes.
All right. There we go. There you go. Pluton Cast Geography.
Finally got one. We're going to have some Pelton cast geography later in the show.
It's
a classic Pelton cast geography.
This is a porter brewed with pumpkin and spices from their Exponential series. And it says, nothing about the beer.
It's a pumpkin porter. It's imperial, so it's probably going to be pretty heavy.
It says, you're holding something special, one of only a few thousand bottles released. Intrigued? Visit epicbrewing.com to explore this limited brew's precise details. I'm like,
that's too late now.
Yeah, we'll never visit it.
Let's just crack this open.
The people of Salt Lake City already love you enough. Is that really pumpkin-y?
It's not really pumpkin-y. It's actually kind of like very porter-y.
Huh.
It's almost coffee-ish.
Really?
As many porters are. But that, I guess, makes sense since you've got like pumpkin spice coffee. So it fits. It works.
Okay.
We'll get a lot of sports to get to. Should we get into it?
All right.
All right. We'll start with perhaps the last facilities update for a period of time here. We've had a long facilities
You'll stretch. Love the facilities update.
You gotta love a nice facilities update. Because on Monday, the Seattle City Council voted by unanimous 8-0 count. That was all the council members except Teresa Mosqueda, who previously voted yes as part of the Select Committee on Civic Arenas but was on vacation on Monday, in favor of the Key Arena rebuild transaction documents, including a lease for the newly renovated building with the Oakview Group. And Mayor Jenny Durkan signed it into law on Tuesday. And now this is happening, assuming that the NHL franchise is in fact secured, which is, you'll recall, required now for Oakview to begin demolition of the arena. So the next step is going to be that the NHL Seattle group, along with Oakview, which is, you know, kind of commingled with that group, will be presenting to the NHL Executive Committee next Tuesday. Presumably that will be followed by a full vote of the NHL Board of Governors on expansion in December, at which point arena construction could start in earnest.
Is this worthy of a toast? I mean, we knew that this was going to happen, but
yeah, I mean, the vote itself is kind of a formality, but the process getting to that point, particularly if you're a hockey fan, is excited about how close we are getting to the reality of the NHL coming to Seattle in either 2020 or 2021. I suppose that is.
I mean, this is it. Hockey's happening. Hockey's coming. We've known that it's coming for a long time, but hockey's coming.
Yeah, something would have to go really, really haywire at this point for hockey not to happen. It's mostly a matter of when, not if.
I look forward to following that closely in 2021.
I'm hoping that by that point, babyest fantasy genius can be our hockey correspondent and fill us in.
He'll be 9.
Yeah.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah, I think so.
You should be a hockey expert by the age of 9. Oh,
the vast majority of people are hockey experts by the age of 9.
How many podcast segments, what podcast segments do you think you could have carried as a 9-year-old, you personally?
Okay, well, I wasn't really quite into sports yet. I probably could have carried a Husky football segment at age 9. I had some takes. I was very pro, was it Walter Bryant, the cornerback who was opposite I can't remember who's the star cornerback who wore number 5 and then was Dana Hall and then was drafted by the 49ers and converted to a safety. I had some takes though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Airplanes. Could you have carried an airplane segment?
Undoubtedly. I could carry an airplane segment today if need be.
God, just the Blue Angels. The thing is, your takes at the time, we'll talk about this more later when we talk about the Seahawks. Your takes at the time probably were just regurgitations of what announcers were saying.
That's reasonable.
So they'd be the same takes as Pete Carroll has.
Oh, no. Oh, boy.
Anyway, hockey's happening.
It is.
Yeah, it's good.
You know what else is happening?
What else is happening?
An NBA preseason game, the final event at Key Arena before this reconstruction begins. And perhaps some more content coming your way soon from the Pelton cast. That game is now, as we record this, 9 days away. It seems hard to believe, but NBA preseason starts this weekend. The Blazers will be playing up in Vancouver against the Toronto Raptors on Saturday. And
that's great. That just can't be real.
It seems inconceivable. So at Media Day, Kevin Durant was asked about playing in Seattle again for the first time since the Sonics moved.
Who asked him this? Do you know?
I don't know specifically who asked him. Here's his comment. It means a lot. I spent a season there. The fans were amazing there to me my first year. It was very devastating how we up and left in the middle of the night. I know those fans have been yearning for basketball for a long, long time.
There we go.
I'm looking forward to going back and playing in front of that crowd again, and I know the energy is going to be amazing.
Kevin Durant has his finger on the pulse of Seattle.
He does. It's your, I had a conversation with someone, perhaps regarding this hashtag content that's coming your way, who like wasn't completely sure what the attitude was going to be of Seattle fans. And I think it's going to be very positive, especially the nostalgia around the Sonics and this being the last game at Key Arena.
It sold out pretty much instantly, right?
Yeah.
And these are presumably Sonics fans who are buying tickets.
Yeah, and I think people, I mean, sure, there's surely probably people who just want to see the Warriors, but I think it's a lot of Sonics fans. And I think it's people, you know, there was a contingent when this was first announced that it's like, oh, the NBA is trolling us, you know, by just giving us a preseason game. But those people probably aren't out there buying tickets.
That's pretty much the worst contingent.
I mean, I understand, I sympathize, I empathize with those concerns, but look, the NBA is not trolling us, first off. This is, as we've learned...
If David Stern would have done it, it would have been trolling us.
This is the work of Warriors president Rick Welts, who is a Seattle native, went to UW, started his career as a ball boy for the Sonics, worked in the Sonics front office in PR and marketing before going on to the NBA league office and continuing what has now been a Hall of Fame career for Rick Welts. He's going about this the right way. He's bringing back people who have been associated with the Sonics, going to celebrate them. And I think this is really going to be a great event. So I'm looking very much.
We should have him on the podcast. Is he going to be in Seattle? Would that be weird to have Rick Welts on the podcast?
No.
Had you considered that before right this second?
Oh, yeah, I'd considered it.
Okay. I mean, if he's spearheading this game, right?
He's talked about it a little bit. So I don't know that we necessarily need to elucidate that he's behind this. But I think it would be interesting to talk to him about his career in Seattle.
And his feelings about taco time.
You know, given Rick Welts' age, he could have been part of the group that was pronouncing it Taco back in 1962, as we heard.
Wow.
Unclear.
I really like the way that Kevin Durant describes the team as up and left in the middle of the night.
I like how he described fans as yearning for basketball.
Yearning. It's like, word. Really, the team didn't, I wouldn't describe the team as up and leaving in the middle of the night. I mean, I guess
there were no moving trucks in the middle of the night. I can vouch for that, having worked for the team.
Well, and then it wasn't the longest process, but it was basically a one-year process.
Yes. I can understand how, from Kevin Durant's perspective, it felt that way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that players weren't following, and maybe you heard this when you did the podcast talking about the last game at Key Arena. Maybe players weren't exactly following the news that closely.
I mean, they were busy playing a season. They were getting asked about it constantly, but... You know, they couldn't really be thinking about it, and they certainly weren't getting updates from management about what was going on. That has been made very clear by players.
Shocked. And there are no players left on the Oklahoma City team that moved, right? Durant would have been the only one.
Yeah.
I mean, Russell was drafted, but...
Jeff Green also moved from Seattle to Oklahoma City, but...
But he's long gone from there.
Long gone, yes. Now playing for the Washington Wizards.
But yeah, it definitely was not up and left overnight. There was no Baltimore Colts style like up and moving. But I like to think of it that way because that's the way it felt.
I agree.
Really, I mean, it kind of felt that way the moment the team was sold.
You know what else is up and left in the middle of the night?
Oh my God,
the Mariners playoff hopes. And to commemorate as they wind down their season. Counting down towards their finale on Sunday, meaningless finale on Sunday. It's time for a Mariners Hot Takes season in review. Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners Hot Takes coming at ya. The year started with the Mariners holding the longest playoff drought in any of the major four pro sports. You know how sick I'm getting of seeing the damn graphic with the longest playoff droughts in major league sports and seeing the Mariners on there. It came up a lot last week because the Timberwolves finally broke the longest drought in the second longest drought in NBA history, but the longest active drought in the NBA. So the Timberwolves have done it. The Buffalo Bills have done it. And still here are the Mariners not making the playoffs. So we need to go to as many wild cards as are necessary. For the Mariners.
All they need.
At some point here to make the playoffs.
All they need is an offense, a defense, and some rule changes.
Do
I have your support.
Of course.
I'm always for more people going to the playoffs. I've told you this. I want 128 team NCAA tournament. You have my support for anything. If you told me you wanted every single team in baseball to go to the playoffs, I'd be all aboard.
Usually I'm totally against this. And this is not at all facetious.
I want to make the whole season out of the playoffs.
2018 also loomed as a make or break season.
And this kind of has to be the season that they sneak in. If they don't make the playoffs this year, get ready for another decade of rebuilding before a Mariners playoff run. 10 years! The Mariners gutted their farm system so much in the past year, you'd think it colluded with Russia.
No.
Nelson Cruz is a free agent. They'll be saddled with $27 million to Felix and Robinson Cano's age 36 to 40-year-old seasons. So gear up now, because the Mariners' future beyond this year looks about as bleak as the Seahawks' secondary without Earl Thomas.
Wow.
A strong start had us channeling a better time in Mariners' history.
Did you hear about that Kendrick and Dr. Dre mixtape that was on the internet today?
I did not hear about that.
You know, I thought it was cool, but you know what it was missing?
What was it missing?
Some Mariners takes included.
Oh, no.
Let me just strap on my old English Renton hat here. You know what year the Mariners are channeling right now?
What year?
Dr. Dre knows. It's not 2001, as you might imagine. That's right. 95 plus no pennies. Add that shit up. But before the season, no one said they could win the Wild Wild West, a division that's untouchable like Elliot Ness. I think.
In May, a James Paxton no-hitter in his native country had us feeling patriotic?
Oh, James Paxton, the best and greatest pitcher. He could have struck out more than 20 batters. The big maple went into Canada and threw a no-hitter from Victoria to Saskatchewan. He owns Canada more than LeBron. Oh, James Paxton, we stand and applaud for thee. Oh, James Paxton, we stand and applaud for thee.
Okay, first off, you are aware that Saskatchewan is not on the opposite side of the country from Victoria, right?
Victoria to Saskatchewan.
I think it's like Prince Edward Island, I believe.
Oh, my.
Maybe at least Nova Scotia.
Like I sang on a podcast. You just did it.
You sure did.
When the Mariners surged ahead of the Angels in the standings, hopes were running high.
It's going to be a cool summer for you. We're going to take it slow. We're just going to play it back game by game. Yeah, Mariners, winners of the second wild card. And you calling it an upset? Yes.
Oh, man, that's exactly what I was hoping for.
I'm hoping that in this case, Shohei Ohtani, the Angels, they're Drake, and the Mariners are Pusha T.
Wow. The day after we get this Brian Colangelo story, we get Kevin Pelton rapping on a podcast.
By the 4th of July, a playoff berth looked all but assured.
Oh, say, can you see? The M's a half game out of first place. Improbably staying in the AL West race. Whose broad ability to defy the fears of stat geeks has produced in a game-winning streak. And a Nelson Cruz Rockets red glare, Denard Span plucking hits out of the air, gave proof that turning the clock wasn't necessary for a playoff spot to be theirs. Oh, say does that Mariners banner yet wave, or the second wild card and an Edwin Diaz save.
I like that. This morning I told you, you're like, are you ready? And I was like, I need to write the national anthem, but about how good the Mariners are. And then I was able to kick that to you because I was dealing with all these children. So you were the one who had to sing on the podcast.
What'd you think about that, though?
It was really, very good.
It was pretty quick work.
You put it together in like 5 minutes also.
I'm most proud of the Stat Geeks winning streak.
I know. I'm not surprised that was the angle that you took.
I mean, it's insane what the Mariners are doing. Like, it makes no sense.
Look, I don't mean to take full credit for this.
Well, obviously you should.
Full credit for this. After last week, I said I was pivoting to positivity and that the Mariners would not lose again.
I don't know if you said that. The Mariners have
not lost since that point.
You said 100% playoff odds, and it's actually getting surprisingly close to that. Their playoff odds, according to FanGraphs, assuming, again, that you count the second wild card, is a playoff spot.
Count the second wild card as a playoff spot?
All right, we had that debate last week. We don't need to have it again. Up to 88%. Per FanGraphs, they are 8 games ahead of the Oakland A's, who are now in that second wild card spot, passing the Angels, who did get Shohei Ohtani back in a designated hitter role.
But then, in classic Mariners fashion, things fell apart, just as another contender emerged in the AL West.
I forgot to write Mariners hot takes this week.
You're just going to talk extemporaneously in that voice?
In the way that the Mariners forgot to play baseball in the last 10 games.
Oh, wow. This is a take.
I told you a week ago that there was a team rising in the West who was going to break a streak of not making the playoffs, and that that team was not the Mariners. Don't look now, but the A's are sitting at a game and a half back of the second wild card spot. They also, there's one team that's making regression to the mean work for them, and that's the A's, because the Mariners are sitting at dead even in run differential. This is a team that somehow is 19 games over 500 and should basically be exactly at 500. And guess what? For the rest of the season, there's one team that has Billy Beane as their GM, is going to be able to make moves to make their team better for the rest of the season. And guess what? That team is not the Mariners.
Oh, the Mariners don't have Billy Beane.
Look, they have Trader Jerry. They already spent all of their prospects that are in their entire farm system last year. And granted, they reaped Marco Gonzalez from those trades. But now they're left with nothing.
To quote Major League 2, their old Mother Hubbard, and only Vaughn's in the cupboard.
And only Jason Bradford's in the cupboard. I learned of this person earlier today.
I mean, honestly, if the Mariners had a Vaughn, Jerry DePoto would already have traded him by this point.
By the way, is Jason the most baseball name?
It's pretty high up in the most baseball names.
The Mariners are 3-7 in their last 10 games. They have used up all of their good luck at the beginning of the season. They're a horse that peaked too early, and here comes a Triple Crown winner from behind.
At the PeltonCast live show in late August, our special guests Isabel and John Fraley tried valiantly to find hope for the Mariners.
So, Mariners, are they going to make the playoffs?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That is for all of you bingo players out there. That's the reckless optimism one.
Wow. We thought for sure that Mike was going to be ticking that bingo square. Yes. I didn't know we were going to get to it this soon.
Not only are the Mariners going to make the playoffs, they're going to win the AL West.
Wait, really?
Welcome. You are welcome.
All right, let's check that. All right, keep going.
All right, well. Actually, that's the end of the show, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Good night. Thanks for coming.
All right. Thanks, everyone. You got your
food. I have no idea what these are underneath. Yeah, therefore, it checks out.
So here's the deal. The Mariners are going to win the AL West because, you know, Felix has been bouncing on and off out of the rotation in the bullpen. Paxton's coming off the DL, and then Marco's going to come off the DL in a few days. And they're just going to win all the starts.
All of the starts.
Besides one.
Are they going to win entirely one-run games?
Yes.
We go back to the month of April and May?
They're done with that now. It's the new phase of the season. Now we're going to win like 2- and 3-run games. Because we haven't tried that yet. You know, the scoring of runs, we haven't been doing that for a while.
I've heard it's overrated.
We're going to try that now for the last 28 games.
Okay.
It's been a strategy, actually, that they've been employing. This is a little bit secret, so I don't want to go past this room, but they've actually been storing up their runs to save it for this final push. And in the meantime...
So like a squirrel saving up nuts for the winter.
Yes. All of those runs are nuts.
So there's something nuts here. That's for sure.
Something's nuts.
Alas, it was already too late for the Mariners, and Tristan declared their season over with weeks left to play. However, he found a silver lining.
Well, today puts a wrap on the Mariners' 2018 season. Yeah, that's right. I'm calling it here first. And look, it was a great ride. James Paxton no-hit the Blue Jays in Canada. Mitch Haniger made the Diamondbacks look even more foolish for trading him. The King confirmed he'll never pitch in a playoff game. We took some diuretic for some eat along the way.
Wait, what?
It was fun. Wait, should I pronounce that? Diuretic.
Oh, I got it now. I got it.
But I'm here to tell all of you Mariners fans that this is good news.
Look, good news.
No one likes a winner. And fortunately, the Mariners don't like to win. Once streaks are broken, the team becomes no fun. Once the Seahawks won the Super Bowl, it was pretty much all downhill from there. The Red Sox decade plus of success after their first World Series, completely empty. The Cubs, never heard of them. And look, I'm being really, truly honest with you. I don't even know if I'll be able to stomach to watch a Bills game this year.
I mean, that does seem to, that again checks out.
Losing is good. Losing builds character. Because of losing, the Mariners have been forced to up their game in every other way. If the Mariners would have won the World Series in 2001, do you think that we'd be eating Din Tai Fung at the ballpark today? No! We'd be eating a cold hot dog and we would like it! So keep cheering for those L's if you want to continue to love the Mariners. And judging by the Mariners farm system and the $150 million that they owe to Robinson Cano and to Felix, this streak isn't going to end anytime soon.
Wow. A bold conclusion there.
They say in baseball, hope springs eternal. So do the hot takes. So we'll see you again next spring.
Whew. We sang a lot. A lot.
More than I remember it even. I remember the anthems. I forgot that there were so many parody of like...
It's a very musical year for the Mariners.
Clearly.
I was going to say that was a fun season, but it actually wasn't.
It was a fun first 3 months.
There was a fun couple of months.
You know what I didn't put in there is you saying I was right about the Mariners. I probably should have put that.
Oh, that you were right?
Yeah.
It's funny how often you are just... You're right about a lot of things.
I'm wrong about a lot of things, too.
The things that you're usually right about are looking at current trends and people getting lucky and then that bouncing back.
Are you thinking of another specific Seattle team in the past year?
Speaking of which.
Saying you have, yeah, I guess that actually probably is a fair assessment. The Sounders winning streak, we talked last week, it had finally come to an end at home. And then there was, now there's a losing streak of sorts. After on Sunday, they went to LA to play the Galaxy and lost 3-0. Not quite as bad as the 5-0 loss they handed the Galaxy here in Seattle. Whew. In their previous meeting, but a disappointing outcome nonetheless. The Sounders were playing without Chad Marshall, who missed the game due to a head injury. He is expected back this weekend. They were also without Harry Shipp, who suffered a hamstring strain in practice last week. He's out 2 to 3 weeks. Same for left back Brad Smith, who left the game early on with a right hamstring strain. And all of a sudden, kind of much like the early part of the season, the Sounders feel very thin and very vulnerable as a result.
It's like there are four seasons in soccer.
I don't know if you've heard this before. The MLS season is really long.
Well, really, the thing that we learned from those Mariners hot takes is that the baseball season is long, too.
I mean, the other thing I didn't put in there is about how the Mariners' playoff odds were the exact inverse of the Sounders' playoff odds. The Mariners made a mountain with their playoff odds. The Sounders so far have made a valley, and we'll have to see if they don't crest on the other side. But fortunately...
In tribute to... The Rainier Valley, where the practice facility is, in the Duwamish neighborhood.
I mean, I would call it the Duwamish Valley, but sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
that was a stretch. So here's the good news, is the Sounders playoff odds remain at 96% even after this two-game losing streak. They're still 3 points up on the Galaxy for the last playoff spot in the West with a match in hand over LA. The Whitecaps are 4 points back and have played the same number of matches as the Sounders, who are fifth in points per match, sixth in the West standings, 1 point back of RSL with a match in hand on Salt Lake. And here's the other good news.
The schedule now becomes very favorable for the Sounders. Their last five matches are against teams in the bottom three of the Western Conference, Colorado, Houston twice, and San Jose, and the very bottom of the Eastern Conference standings, Orlando City. And that starts this Saturday when they host the Colorado Rapids trying to snap this new losing streak. The Rapids come in with the worst rating in MLS in the 538 Soccer Power Index. And that you'll recall that the Sounders started their hot streak with a road win against the Rapids on the 4th of July, immediately after I had written their season off.
I was going to say, nobody's recalling. That was so long ago.
It was a long time ago. I remember it, though. It was within hours of me saying the season was over. And then it wasn't. And that's good.
So it's not time to panic for the Sounders?
Not quite yet.
Wow.
The injuries are disconcerting.
Does it feel like the team peaked a little bit too early?
I don't know if I believe that.
Is that a thing?
I don't think it's a
peaking.
Like, I don't think they were like trying so hard that now they're tired. I don't think that's it. They were awfully lucky during the winning streak.
So you're saying basically they were unlucky for most of the beginning of the season?
Yeah.
Then weren't they just legit bad for a little while?
To some extent.
Then they got very lucky for a chunk of time, won a bunch of matches, and now things are evening out.
A little bit.
And they're probably more or less at the place that they should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could plausibly get up to fourth in the West. And we'll see. Like, you know, it'll be a trade-off of possibly diminished roster due to injuries against this very easy schedule to close out the season. And we'll see what wins out.
I mean, the reality of the situation is they just need to make the playoffs.
Yeah, and then anything can happen.
Anything can happen.
You know, it's not. I mean, it actually is long, but the series aren't very long. And that's the MLS Cup playoffs.
Yeah, they are. but the reality of the situation is this is probably not a team that's going to go to the MLS Cup this year.
No, but then you wouldn't have said 2 years ago that they're going to go to the MLS Cup and then they won it.
Sure. Just because that happened at any point ever doesn't mean that it's going to happen again.
I think it just means that the MLS Cup is really, the playoffs are really, really unpredictable in the MLS because they're two-game series at most.
Making the playoffs, you would consider this a successful season for the Sounders, even if they lose in the first round?
I would say probably yes. And I certainly don't think you can say at this point that Brian Schmetzer has done a poor job. I think he's done a terrific job handling all these different rosters he's been handed.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to monitor that situation as the season somehow continues to keep going.
Later Saturday, we have the Huskies hosting number 20 BYU at 5:30 p.m. on Fox, coming off a 27-20 win Saturday over Arizona State that was probably more lopsided, I think, than the final score indicated.
Yes.
Sun Devils got a fairly late touchdown, Keel Harry with a long punt return, and they paid that off. It never really felt like they were any particular danger of losing the game, even though they probably were. That was Andre Bocelli who had the reception on the sideline that was correctly overturned to a catch on third down that ended the game on replay. I believe that was Andre Bocelli.
That seems right. I don't remember who it was. It was incredibly late. This game started at 7:30.
That is accurate. It was quite late. And it was a very lengthy review for being that late. But it was a strong performance from Jake Browning here against decent but not elite opposition. I think this was the kind of game that you want and need from Jake Browning to be successful going forward.
And the Huskies outgained Arizona State by more than 100 yards in this one. I mean, like, the penalty is only 3 for 30. But when you look at the yards gained from penalties plus the overall yards in the game, the Huskies outgained them by 140 yards. Like, this was not a 7-point victory. Arizona State, and we talked about this, didn't feel like they were playing to win the game in a lot of situations, despite what Herm may have said on Hard Knocks like 12 years ago.
Yeah, it was a very conservative strategy. They barely threw it all, despite the fact that, you know, their passing game led by Manny Wilkins has been so much more effective than their rushing game this season.
3.9 yards per attempt. It was like they had Andrew Luck back there.
We've got some more Andrew Luck stats coming.
Wait, do we really?
We do.
Wait, why are we going to talk about Andrew Luck?
In the context of Sam Bradford.
Oh, God.
Exactly.
Really, I wouldn't say that anything necessarily worked for Arizona State. Maybe staying competitive in the game worked. And again, this like one return by N'Keal Harry.
But they matriculated the ball.
They just didn't have, there was no firepower to that offense whatsoever. No. And that's the thing about this Husky defense, is it's a stifling defense. I think we knew going into this game that Arizona State, I mean, talent-wise, the Huskies are almost better at basically every single position than Arizona State.
Yeah, I guess that's possibly true.
So they couldn't have really come into this game and expected to compete. I mean, considering this is a team that just got bulldozed by San Diego State the week beforehand, this wasn't a game that they should have been competitive in.
By the way, I got to look this up. What San Diego State, what they did last weekend, because I think they were struggling against some massively lesser opponent. It was not certainly a performance that indicated that Arizona State, you know, was reasonable to lose on the road to San Diego State.
The most important thing that happened last week, there were a couple of them. Number one, Savon Ahmed, 10 carries for 71 yards.
That was nice to see.
Get this man the ball!
Oh, yeah.
What are we doing?
It was 23-20 they beat Eastern Michigan.
Oh, my God. The entire Pac-12 South is basically at the level of competition as Eastern Michigan.
That could be.
What conference is Eastern Michigan in? We need to wake Baby Fantasy Genius up.
I believe they're in the MAC.
Okay, yeah. If you put all of the Pac-12 South in the MAC, I wouldn't guarantee that one of those teams would win it.
I got to say, there was some action between USC and WazU on Friday night. That some was some grade A action.
If it's Friday, it counts as action. It doesn't count as Pac-12 after dark.
Technically, it probably has to be a Tuesday to count as action. Tuesday or Wednesday.
I actually thought to myself earlier today, I'm like, I wonder if there's a MAC game going on. Turn on some sports. Because the Mariners season ended in August, as far as I recall. Savon Ahmed, though, 7.1 yards per carry. Explosive. Every single time he touches the ball, explosive. Especially when you get him outside.
Yeah, good things happen.
But the most important thing that happened in this game was Jake Browning going, shh, quieting the haters.
Wow.
The haters were out there.
You think they were quieted? I don't feel like they were quieted.
They were quieted for a week, at least, right? The haters had their pitchforks out. And Jake Browning going 15 of 22 for 9.2 yards per attempt, 11.9 adjusted yards per attempt. This was an excellent game by Jake Browning.
It was. I don't like adjusted yards per attempt because it gives you too much credit for touchdown passes, in my opinion, of which he had three in this game.
Ty Jones deserves some credit for some of those touchdown passes.
Right. He deserves a lot of credit for the last touchdown pass where he kind of rolled out and kept rolling and it seemed like nothing was good was going to happen. And then finally found Cade Otton.
Yeah, getting Cade Otton involved in the
offense. Three catches for 40 yards.
The new Will Dissly, they cannot get Drew Sample involved in the offense, but Cade.
He had two catches to Cade Otton's three. I don't,
three for 40. Cade Otton was out there making things happen. And I had never heard of him before Saturday, so.
Well, clearly you're paying very close attention to Husky football thus far.
Had you heard of Cade Otton?
Sure.
You knew who he was?
Yeah.
I couldn't even hear what you were saying at the game. No, I was like, Cade Otton, huh? I thought his name was like Kay Felder.
I was maybe workshopping some Otton throw the ball to him more or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, God. Hopefully those were shut down.
The famous Cousin Katie just turned off this podcast. That's a joke. She would never listen to this podcast.
Yeah, good point. She's busy listening to Talkin' Taco Time.
Also, we should give a shout-out to Ben Burke-Hervin with 20 tackles on defense.
20 tackles!
And two sacks for Benny Potoahe to go along with his 7 tackles.
It was like, really, it was a 7-point game, but this was the kind of 7-point game where that you never sweat at any point. You were never nervous about the outcome. This was 7 going on 30. Like, they could have won this game by 3 touchdowns easily.
Yeah, if just a few things had swung differently. So the interesting thing is, despite the fact that BYU comes in ranked number 20 on the strength of their upset win over then number 6 Wisconsin, 24-21 at Camp Randall Stadium 2 weeks ago, they actually rate slightly worse by ESPN's Football Power Index ratings than Arizona State does. In their other games, not nearly as impressive. They won 28-23 at Arizona, lost 21-18 at home to Cal as part of their continuing tour of the Pac-12 that will also include Utah later this season, and beat McNeese State 30-3 at home last weekend. If you try to figure out sort of what happened in that Wisconsin game and try to get the anatomy of that upset. The big thing, I think, was BYU's running offense in that game. 28 carries for 191 yards, 6.8 yards per carry. Then they followed that up last weekend by running for 3.8 yards per carry against McNeese State. I mean, maybe that Cowboy rush defense is tough. I don't know.
You know they're called the Cowboys.
I'm pretty sure about that. Again, maybe Fantasy Genius could confirm that for us. They also did a strong job against the Badgers' run offense, which ran for a season-low 4.7 yards per carry in that game. But still, it was one of those games where I think if you play it, Wisconsin wins at least 95 times out of 100, and this was just kind of one of those five times where the things went wonky.
We'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out great for UW, assuming that it does not happen this weekend.
I mean, either way, even if it does happen, it's still good for UW.
Exactly. But the oddsmakers certainly don't think that's going to happen, is despite the Huskies being woefully unable to cover last weekend's 18-point spread, they have been installed again as 17.5-point favorites for this one, which shows you, as usual, that the oddsmakers know way more than the pollsters.
I mean, really, they should just make the polls.
I don't feel like the NCAA would go for that.
Oddsmakers make the polls.
I feel like I have some concerns. Also, USC would consistently be ranked too high because of the fact that they're a public team.
We should see what USC's spread is this week. I got to say, I can't imagine that they're feeling that excited about USC right now.
They won last week.
They won by 3 against Wazoo in some action.
It was action. So BYU's offense rated 77th in the Football Power Index efficiency. They are not good at throwing the football. They won that Wisconsin game with quarterback Tanner Mangum, who is a third-year starter coming back from a ruptured Achilles that ended his 2017 season, throwing for 89 yards in that game. He's never been a particularly accurate passer. He's a career 59%.
They really won the way that Wisconsin likes to win, too.
They did. It was
must have been very embarrassing for Wisconsin.
But he's averaging just 9.1 yards per completion this season, down from 10.5 last year before the injury. Squally Canada leads their running back committee. He had 11 carries for 118 yards against Wisconsin, really powering that rush attack, but averaged just 3.7 yards per carry against Arizona and Cal. So
his name is Squally Canada?
I believe that's a nickname, but yes.
Okay.
They have no receiver with more than 129 yards through their first 4 games. This is not a high-powered BYU attack. They also have not had particularly good pass rush. They have just 4 sacks through 4 games. So that's a good sign, because part of what we didn't mention in that Jake Browning performance, and Coach Pete was very sure to mention this clearly, the pass blocking improved dramatically last weekend. I think that was a factor in Jake Browning's success as well.
Do we feel like, I don't remember what the perspective was of Arizona State going in, whether they are a good defensive team or not. Was this because
they're an okay defensive team?
Okay.
They're probably not quite as good defensively as BYU is, I would say.
Okay.
BYU does rank 4th overall in special teams. That could be a big advantage for them in this matchup.
USC minus 3.
Who are they playing?
Arizona. In Arizona, actually, I feel like that is a pretty good spread for USC.
I don't know. I feel like that's a really low spread because Arizona's been terrible this season. So I don't know what to tell you.
It's really feels like a pickup to me. I mean, you're saying that USC on a neutral site is a 6-point favorite over Arizona?
Has Arizona won? I mean, they've won a game.
They're 2-2. USC is 0-4 against the spread. Arizona's 2-2 against the spread.
I told you they were a public team. I'm not disputing that part of it.
Well, I think they're going to be 0-5 against the spread after that one. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a game that the Huskies should comfortably win. I can see a scenario where, much like last week's game,
Arizona lost to this BYU team.
Yeah, they did. I can see a scenario where, much like last week, the game ends up closer than it really is, but the Huskies should be able to take care of business.
It really depends on how kind of BYU approaches the game. But this is not a bad defense that they're playing. This might be, honestly, one of the better defenses that they play all year. So I could see them slowing down the Huskies a little bit. They did a little bit of kind of grinding it out. There's a little bit of Seahawk offense in the Husky game plan last week, because Gaskin ran the ball quite a few times and was not that effective. So I could
see... But he wasn't ineffective. He just wasn't as effective as Savon Ahmed was.
Well, for a college running
back...
And
even granted on a very tiny sample, Kamari Pleasant.
It would be nice to see the Huskies kind of doing some things to spread it out, work more players in the offense. And I think, honestly, Bush Hamden deserves a little bit of credit for kind of tightening things up there.
Yeah.
We didn't see the open. Have you seen this in replay, the opening play where Andre Bocelli threw an interception?
Nope.
Well, clearly they were trying something out if Andre Bocelli threw an interception. I do not know the circumstances of how that happened, though. But, you know, this. I agree that this could be a little bit of a grind-out game, though. This is the type of game where the Huskies' defense, I think, will shine in it. And it could be like a 28-17 type game, something like that.
That seems reasonable.
So,
chances of victory?
85%.
I'm going 90.
Wow! 90%!
You think that the Huskies are going to lose a game if Tanner Mangum throws for 89 yards?
He might not throw for 89 yards.
But he probably, if it's UW secondary, I think the odds are...
You could say the same thing about Wisconsin.
I don't think Wisconsin's secondary is as good as UW secondary.
Well, no, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, would you imagine that, if I would have told you going into that Wisconsin game that Tanner Mangum was going to throw for 89 yards, do you think that Wisconsin was going to lose?
No.
And they lost.
It's true.
You have to factor in, I mean, I guess you said there was the 5% chance, and they just happened to hit that 5% chance. But there's still any chance.
And I gave them more chance of that of beating UW, which I think is probably a slightly better team than Wisconsin.
So, what does FPI give the chances of victory?
93%. FPI is very confident about the Huskies in this one.
This is not quite. It's not quite the super late, like 7:30 p.m. Pac-12 after dark, but you always have to be nervous.
Yeah,
but again, this might be a situation where, you know, BYU has a stout defense, but the Huskies might be better at almost every position than them.
Probably.
So this is, and they're playing at home. This is a game that they should win.
Yes.
Who do we have next? The week after.
The week after will be UCLA.
So then they have a bye week.
No, it's still a road Pac-12 game. It's not a bye week.
I knew you'd get annoyed about that too.
And then after that, Oregon.
Oh my God.
Can I read you a tweet? This is completely unrelated. Can I read you a tweet just now from my friend Dan Wojcicki, who covers the NBA for the LA Times? I might have just decided Return of the Mac is my favorite song.
Just decided?
Yeah, that was a reply from his LA Times colleague, Andrew Greif. Only just now?
There we go.
Yeah. All right, needed to get that in there.
We should do a top five songs ever. And all five of them will be Return of the Mac. I'm like single-handedly, I was going to say, I guess I'm not single-handedly out here leading the charge for Return of the Mac.
Right.
Dan Wojcicki is too.
You know what? Return of the Mac, that also might come back.
Wow.
Hashtag content. All right. Time for the Seahawks, who got their first victory of the 2000.
Oh, okay. Steve Wilks is the coach of Arizona, or the Cardinals. Bronco Mendenhall is gone. It's like, I'm pretty sure Steve Wilks is the guy who's bringing basketball back to Seattle from Golden State.
What?
What is the dude's name from the Warriors?
Oh, Rick Welts.
Mm.
That wasn't even close enough for me to understand that reference at first. By the way, Bronco Mendenhall is no longer the coach at BYU. He coaches at Virginia. The coach of BYU is Kalani Sitake.
Kalani Sitake?
Yeah.
Is it pronounced Kalani?
I don't think so. Okay. Pretty sure it's pronounced Kalani.
If you would have asked me who the coach of the Cardinals was, no idea. Right?
We'll get to the Cardinals in a second. First, okay. Let's talk about the Seahawks, who got their first win of 2018.
There we go.
Toast to that. Sunday against the Dallas Cowboys by a 24-13 final. All right. Our Seahawks topics this week. Number one, do we feel better about the Seahawks coming out of this game?
Can we talk about that last?
All right.
Second to last, maybe.
Or did you also want to save, is the running game fixed?
No, we can talk about that now.
Okay.
So, the Seahawks won, right?
Again, that checks out.
My question for you is it bad that the Seahawks won?
I don't think it's bad.
Because this goes hand in hand with is the run game fixed question.
Of course. Because there was a lot of people who were unfurling the mission accomplished banner after this game and talking about how this is the ideal Seahawks performance and everything like that. And, you know, a running back ran for 100 yards, which sounds better until you know that he had 32 carries. Which, by the way, 32 carries for Chris Carson. God, that's a lot of carries. Good thing they didn't draft a running back in the first round.
That is just... Well, and also when Pete was saying that Chris Carson looked gassed and he had to just ignore it or whatever, it's like...
Oh, no. Oh.
Maybe he was. Maybe Chris Carson was just really exhausted and the run game would have been fixed if he wasn't gassed.
It definitely seemed to reinforce a lot of philosophies of football from the Seahawks coaching staff that may not be the most optimal strategies for
not just coaching staff everywhere.
Well,
right?
I don't really think what the media or fans think about it has that much influence going forward is compared to the coaching staff.
I mean, that's what I'm saying is this bad? Because the coaching staff saw there are two things that they saw in this game, and they saw the rushing attempts and the scoreboard.
Pete did cite the rush attempts plus pass completion stat that Brian Schottenheimer has been popularizing, which of course treats a pass completion like just the sheer choice to run the ball the same as actually completing a pass.
I mean, it's such a backwards perspective where Pete is like, I don't even know if this is true, where he's like, you know, if you get these, whatever the number is, the combination of rushing attempts plus completions, then you win most often. But he's not looking at it and saying, okay, most often teams are running more because they're running out the clock at end of game.
It's the classic.
Or whatever. It's just like...
This is... Football Outsiders was literally founded to combat this theory in 2003. It's 15 years later now. So that's not great. Also, the idea that like Russell Wilson managed the game.
Oh, God. I almost vomited when I heard that one. This is to go into this conversation for the Ben Baldwin. He tweeted earlier today. Did you see this?
About the offensive line?
I'm going to correct his tweet. Okay. He says, I've listened to 3 Seahawks-specific podcasts this week, and all of them had an extended digression to discuss whether running backs matter. You're welcome. What he means is full page ad. You're welcome.
Do we even need to have that conversation?
No, we don't need to have that conversation.
We're kind of past that.
And we're aware about whether running backs matter or not. And look, Chris Carson, fine. Like, he ran 32 times. This is nothing about Chris Carson. I like Chris Carson.
Right.
I think that he's a fine running back. I like what he does. But this style of offense is not an effective way to win games long term. And the problem was, to me, I don't want to say that it's bad because they needed to win this game to salvage the season. Right?
Exactly.
If they lose this game, the season's over. No matter how they did it, but them winning this game means that they're probably going to lose future games.
It also means they're not going to trade Earl Thomas, which may or may not be a good thing, depending on whether they ever change their minds about the idea that, hey, maybe Earl Thomas, who is still the most important player on our defense, who is coming up with multiple interceptions to save this game, might be worth having going
forward. I've got it still deep down inside of me somewhere that they're going to extend Earl, that they're going to see Earl and realize that he's different than other players.
Remember, hope is a bad thing. Maybe the worst of things, and no bad thing ever dies. Nihilism, man, embrace it. The Earl Thomas saga, it was an interesting week for that. I don't want to totally derail that conversation, but we learned that he's just not going to practice if he has so much as a headache, which is a completely understandable decision from him without a long-term contract.
He needs to go on the podium, and he needs to do verbatim the practice we talked about practice thing.
Yeah.
Come
I don't
on.
Know. Does like, it feel derivative, though?
Enter the zeitgeist, Earl. This is your moment.
True. Pete Carroll responded that there are consequences to doing that. Those consequences do not apparently affect his ability to play in games.
Yeah,
which is good.
Unclear.
That would be terrible.
Well, honestly, you have to ask yourself, I mean, I suppose precedent is the only issue that they could be concerned with, but why are there consequences to that? When you're Earl Thomas, you need to practice?
I do think that there are issues in terms of communication, and I think we probably would look a little less favorably on Earl Thomas not practicing had Ezekiel Elliott not stepped out of bounds before he caught that touchdown pass when Thomas chose to pressure Dak Prescott instead of trying to stick with Elliott on that play, which I'm not saying he would have made a different play if he practiced, but I'm just saying the conversation would probably be different in that scenario.
Yeah, and maybe the outcome of the game would have been different.
So
maybe instead of having this like run parade that they had, right? They had a Super Bowl parade because they ran the ball and won a game.
Good mission accomplished banner unfurled outside of VMAC.
The entire situation may be different.
405.
But our interest in the team being competitive this season, they needed to win the game no matter how they did it.
Yes.
The problem was, because of this win, so many people are going to take the wrong messages from it. So no, the running game isn't fixed. They literally just ran the ball.
They ran a lot.
They did it. The running volume is fixed.
It didn't necessarily create more makeable third downs.
What is the next topic?
Do you want to talk about third downs?
So, to me, the difference between winning and losing this game, granted, we know that third downs are important.
You can say most any game.
But, and this has been the case, they probably would have won at Chicago, at Denver, had they been more successful on a couple of these plays. But when you look at scoring drives for the Seahawks in this game, how many times they completed a third down? I think they only had two drives throughout the game that they got even one third down conversion and didn't score. So their first possession, which the Seahawks are really good at moving the ball in their first possession and not scoring.
Oh, they excel at that. They almost specialize in it.
So they actually had two third down conversions on that first possession and then ended up punting. By the way, is Michael Dixon still that good?
He had a much better game this week than in week two.
The Michael Dixon steam has definitely waned a little bit.
Yes.
We're not coming up with hashtag MV punter anymore. So first drive, they get to midfield with two third down conversions in there, impressively, one of which by the roughing the passer call on Russell that was kind of deep in Seahawks territory. Then a three and out. Then a three and out. So that's two in a row. Then on the Seahawks' first touchdown drive to Jerron Brown, they had two third down conversions, or actually three because the touchdown... Yeah, three third down conversions. So they were 3 for 3 on that series on third downs. None of this has to do with the volume of rushing the ball. This is just happenstance that they happen to pick up third downs.
Because many of these are third and long, correct?
It was 3rd and 6, 3rd and 3, and 3rd and 10.
Okay.
Then their next possession, in which they scored again on the Tyler Lockett series, they had two third down conversions, both the third downs that they had on that series, obviously. There was a 3rd and 1 that Trey Madden picked up, and then the 52-yard touchdown to Tyler Lockett.
On 3rd and 9?
Yes, on 3rd and 9. Then on the next series, where they ended up getting the field goal from Janikowski at the end of the half, they had another third down conversion in there, so they were 1 of 1 on that series. Are you hearing what I'm saying?
I have a theory that I've never tested.
Hold on. Listen to the second half. 3 and out. 3 and out. That series, I think, lasted in the fourth quarter. They ended up scoring on the series. Never even got to third down on that series, actually.
That's actually the hope, by the way. It's not to convert a lot of third downs, we've got to but to avoid third downs altogether.
This was the Chris Carson touchdown. So they never actually even got to third down on that series. Then.
Oh, by the way, a toast to a running back touchdown.
There we go.
Hope you got your taco time, Chris Taco.
3 and out. 3 and out. I mean, do you hear how many 3 and outs there are? And then on what was more or less the last series of the game where they were just running out the clock, they picked up one third down.
So I have a theory that I've never tested, and I don't have the time to test. So maybe Ben B will listen to this and choose to test us. And by the way, it was great to see him in person last weekend, hang out before the Husky game. My theory is that when the Seahawks pick up a first down, they are much more likely to pick up a subsequent first down than they were to pick up the original first down. So like if they pick up the original first down 30% of the time, they pick up the next first down 45% of the time, that it's some dramatic difference even compared to other NFL teams. I mean, you probably do that more often in general just because of the fact that you know, the conditions are probably more favorable when you pick up.
I'm going to tell Bill Barnwell that you're making an argument for momentum right now. He's going to have to write another piece called Nomentum for you.
Well, that's why I want to run the numbers to see if it's true or not. I don't want to just... That's why it's a theory, not a conclusion.
I mean, the reason that this would be true, I mean, I guess if you're looking at for just for the Seahawks, you'd have a small sample size or whatever. But throughout the league, it would be true because good teams are probably more likely to pick up first downs and then more likely to pick up
subsequent first downs. But you're comparing it to their chances. Like, compare it team by team, not league-wide.
Okay.
Okay, other topics.
But so anyway, what I'm saying is that the Seahawks won this game because they basically picked up 6 third downs. Because and they
I mean, happen, that's not an unusually high number of third downs.
But they happen to overall string them together on certain possessions. And really what happened is pure luck. They managed to get Tyler Lockett open on a touchdown pass where the Cowboys secondary made a bad play.
But I take Pete Carroll's argument in his Monday morning appearance on ESPN 710 that part of what happened there is the Seahawks were able to use tempo to create some confusion among the Cowboys.
Sure, tempo's great. Everybody likes tempo. Tempo and running don't usually go particularly hand-in-hand unless you're Oregon in, like, 2007.
I think Oregon in, like, 2012, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Unless you're Oregon under Chip Kelly.
Yeah.
They were able to use tempo and run the ball extremely effectively.
Yes, they were.
That is not happening with this Seahawks team. But do you see what I mean? Like, they are learning bad lessons from this. What they are looking at is not third down conversions. They're looking at rushing attempts.
Yeah.
And the difference in this game was not rushing attempts. It was completely fucking pointless. The thing that mattered was third down conversions.
I don't know if it was completely pointless, but I would say they won despite it rather than winning because of it. All right, let's talk about injuries on the offensive line, adjustments there. Ethan Pusick missed this game, and we saw J.R. Sweezy move from right guard to left guard, making room for the return of D.J. Fluker. And it turns out there are a lot of players with initials on the Seahawks offensive line. It had not occurred to me before now. That seemed to be a more effective unit.
Who are the people with initials? Dwayne Brown, Ethan Pusick,
J.R. and D.J.
Okay, fine.
They were the two people I mentioned.
Two players.
But despite the fact that Joey Hunt was replacing Justin Britt at center in this game, I mean, it wasn't a great performance by the offensive line, but it was a solid performance by the offensive line, all things considered. And it looks like that's going to be the way they line up at the guard spots again this Sunday, even if Pusick is able to play. Britt, if he does go, which it seems likely he will reclaim his starting center job.
I'm trying to do some math on the amount of plays that they ran. I think they ran significantly more plays than Dallas, right? Because Dallas had 19 rushing attempts and 34 passing attempts. And Seattle had 39 rushing attempts, Jesus Christ, and 26 passing attempts.
Yeah, that checks out.
And the Seahawks gained less yards than the Cowboys. So, I mean, we could find yards per play easily, but it's just not listed right here. But I just don't know who you're complimenting in this game.
I mean, Russ was not under duress a lot of this game. And that, I think, counts as progress.
Okay. He was only sacked twice.
That's not a lot.
Okay. I mean, our standards are very low. You know,
Dak Prescott was sacked 5 times in this game. You got nothing here?
I mean, I just don't. I don't look at this game and say to myself, yes, the line's better. Like, this, nothing is fixed. Nothing is different.
Things right can now be better and not fixed. There is a medium between that.
Look, maybe running the ball more meant that Russ was slightly less under duress.
That's not what I said. I said the offensive line played better.
Maybe the offensive line played better. I would attribute it to...
I think you might be being needlessly pessimistic about this game.
No, I would attribute it more to location. Because, Grant, they played... Game one was the ultimate trap game. We knew it going in, right? They're playing against a person who has won Defensive Player of the Year. Probably, and also, Khalil Mack must have won a Defensive Player of the Year at some point, right?
I believe he did, yes.
2 consecutive weeks, they played against players who won Defensive Player of the Year. Nobody on the Cowboys has ever done that.
But the Dallas pass rush had been reasonably effective by committee.
There's just...
I think you're poo-pooing this.
I'm poo-pooing it because it's the truth.
I mean, granted, they still rank number 31 in PFF's grades for offensive line.
The Seahawks?
Yes.
So then why am I not poo-pooing it? I just don't look at it and say, oh, everything's fixed. That is what is happening.
Why didn't
this is
say
all
that?
Outcome-based. What you're talking about is outcome-based, not process-based.
Well,
and you are the person who ultimately should care the most about the process. And you don't even fucking care about the process right now. God.
I didn't sit there and rewatch every single play. I'm sorry. I didn't have time for that.
We needed Ben to do a cut-up of every offensive line play. But
he only does that when it's bad.
to prove why George Fant is a great player. They did not face the type of pass rusher that they faced in week one and two.
Two sacks is a win for the Seahawks.
They were at home.
If the Seahawks...
There is a big difference between being at home and on the road and between facing an elite pass rusher and not an elite pass rusher. That's the entire
The offensive line was great on at home last year. Oh, just wonderful.
Okay, maybe the offensive line. I just don't know statistically if it bears out that they're actually that much better.
You can't be happy about anything.
Because this sucks.
What?
I listened to this interview on Monday morning with Pete Carroll, thrilled about this win. We're talking about backwards football. Nothing about the process of this game suggested to me that they can win another game.
You're too upset about this. Way too upset about this.
I mean, I'll be optimistic at the end, just like last week. I'll come full circle.
As far as other injuries, Doug Baldwin back practicing. Seems like there's a chance he could return to play this weekend, which would be cool.
I'm excited about that one.
KJ Wright does not seem close to practicing, which makes it good news that Michael Kendricks will play this week.
There we go. Love Michael Kendricks.
Deion Jordan has a hand wrist injury of yet unknown severity that could imperil his availability.
Let's get some more Rasheem Green in there.
Well, he also missed practice today.
Oh, no.
So that's why they called up Brandon Jackson from the practice squad, and it seems possible he could be in the rotation this weekend.
Do you see the special teams tackle that Shaquem made?
Yeah.
I mean, like, it was
hard to miss.
So exciting to see, because that's the role that he should be in for this year.
Absolutely.
Despite all the people calling in the preseason saying he should be starting from day one.
You. Absolutely you. Literally only you.
It was very cool to see him filling the role that he should be filling in his rookie season, and knowing that, like, the instincts and the speed were there, and it's something that
The ability to wrap up.
Yeah. Like, that he'll put all the other pieces together and be a starting linebacker in the NFL by next year, 2 years from now.
Is Ken Norton getting enough credit for his role in the Seahawks defense?
Absolutely not.
I mean, his name has really not been mentioned almost at all. The counter argument here, of course, is the Seahawks have not as yet faced a murderer's row of quarterbacks, going Trevor Siemian, Mitch Trubisky, and then Dak Prescott, who has struggled considerably this season with his lack of weapons in the passing game. We'll probably know a lot more about the Seahawks defense in 2 weeks.
When they play the Cardinals. After they face Josh Rosen or Sam Bradford.
Josh Rosen. But still.
And we honestly might not even know for 3 or 4 weeks, because
the Rams are unstoppable.
The Rams are unstoppable. I mean, you saw the 3-and-out percentage from Bill Barnwell.
Yes.
6%.
That's not very many. You'll notice that you said shit a lot of 3-and-outs when you were talking about the Seahawks.
That's probably more than the Rams have had all season in that game.
That's quite possible.
So
In fact, it's mathematically certain, I think, actually.
Yeah. So the Seahawks had more 3-and-outs in their one shining game that they played than the Rams have had all season. 100% chance of losing. Lock it in 2 weeks from now.
Oh, boy. All right. Should we talk about the Arizona Cardinals?
First on Ken Norton. And I also wanted to ask if we feel better. That's what we're going to come back to.
I'm pretty sure I got your answer.
No, you haven't. On Ken Norton, I mean, the defense is great. So far, the defense has played very well. I mean, I suppose, it's one of the things where it's tough to judge the process because they've created a lot of turnovers.
Right, which is not something this defense has always done. And I don't think that is anything schematic that they're doing under Ken Norton. I think a lot of that is, well, A, the quarterbacks they've played, and B, just randomness.
Yeah, but who knows? I mean, sometimes those things can continue. That's the thing, is like, things like this, the NFL season is so short, as opposed to both baseball and soccer, things don't always even out in the NFL season. You could have a year where you create a ton of turnovers, and it just continues.
Is that a Dave Niehaus reference there?
So, I don't think that you can look at it and say, like, this will definitely dry up or whatever. They may still continue to create turnovers. And the places that they're stopping teams, it feels like the right places to stop teams. I mean, you look at Dak at 19 for 34 for 168 yards. Like, sure, they gave up a lot of yards on the ground, but you know what? Running doesn't matter. So give up those yards on the ground.
As I mentioned on Twitter, on the Peltoncast Twitter after last week's game, teams now 5-10 in the past 5 seasons when they run for at least 8 yards per carry in a game. And there's probably some explanations for that in terms of teams running fewer times when they're behind and therefore, you know, having more variability in their yards per carry. But also, it just doesn't seem like running well is that important.
Yeah. There's probably like a certain amount of yards that do affect running well, like a combination of carries plus yards per carry that equals doing well, but clearly that is not it. So the answer to your question of do we feel better? Yes.
Really? After all that?
Because I don't know if I'm convinced that... I think this was the offense based upon... It's all outcome based. Everything the Seahawks do is outcome based. They're not a good process team. Like maybe defensively they have a sense of good process. Offensively, Pete Carroll is not going to be able to understand good process. That's it. Like just going into this, we know that the team will not be able to understand good process. Just matter of fact, it's not changing. They're not going to get better at it. They will pass because they have to pass. And they will run if they get to run, because they want to run.
It didn't need to be reinforced.
So I actually think the best process that we got was weeks 1 and 2, and knowing that if Brian Schottenheimer needs to pass the ball, he will. Although, can we get a trick play in there or something? Like, just open up the playbook a little bit.
Would you like Andrea Bocelli to throw a pass?
I mean, you see the Dolphins out there, and you're like, things seem like they're going well for them. Really... Just open up the playbook a little bit, maybe after the bye week. But the team just needed to win. That's it. And they won. This was the game that mattered with regards to the season. The NFC West and the whole NFC didn't have a great week. I mean, you can look at it and you can say...
Force him out for Jimmy G.
There's probably one wild card team coming from the NFC South at least. Beyond that, it's wide open. This is me writing off the division because the Seahawks are not winning the division. That's over. But the NFC North doesn't look great. The NFC South looks like it has maybe 3 or 4 pretty good teams, but maybe they're all just beat each other up and you'll end up with 2 teams in the playoffs rather than 3. The NFC East looks like they might only have 1 team. It's really kind of wide open for that second wild card, maybe a little bit more so than we thought.
Okay.
So going into the season, and the chances of getting to 3-3 heading into the bye week, seems like the most likely outcome. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know what's going to be necessary to do that? Is beating the Arizona Cardinals this Sunday. Well, assuming you think that there's 0% chance of beating the Rams, I guess. So let's talk a little bit about the Cardinals, who are off to...
Do you think there's more than a 0% chance of beating the Rams?
I do think there's more than a 0% chance of beating the Rams. I think it's like 5 to 10.
Yeah. Miracles happen.
I think it's like BYU beats UW.
BYU beat Wisconsin.
Exactly. Seahawks playoff odds up to 35% in Football Outsiders simulations. Of those,
I think Football Outsiders is a little overrating the Seahawks.
I mean, they have them basically as an average team.
Little overrating.
Okay. Of those 11%.
The defense probably is not the 6th best defense.
They have them winning the division 11% of the time. Well, there's no opponent adjustments in there yet.
That's like what happens. Like, what would need to happen? I guess here's my question for you. Who would need to get injured on the Rams for the Seahawks to win the division? I don't think Jared Goff is enough.
That's interesting. Putting Sean Mannion at the controls of that offense would be a fascinating experiment to watch. I mean, I don't want Jared Goff to get injured. You know, maybe if Jared Goff decides to go take some weeks off to learn where the sun rises and sets.
Do you think, though, like, what would your percentage, if the percentage chances, do you actually feel like the percentage chances of the Seahawks winning the division are 11%?
Probably not, but randomness happens in an NFL season, as you pointed out earlier.
So to swing it to better than 50%, what would have to happen to the Rams?
Okay, well, you're going to have to take off Goff and Aaron Donald.
I think you need Aaron Donald gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Aaron Donald holds out because his extension isn't big enough.
So if they lose their starting quarterback and star defensive player, you would think about it.
Yes.
Well, I mean, this is already in the context of Aqib Talib going to IR.
Correct.
Okay.
Anyway, Arizona is off to an 0-3 start under first-year head coach Steve Wilks. They have, through 3 weeks, the 11th worst offensive DVOA in the Football Outsiders database back through 1989. They rank number 31 in DVOA in passing, number 29 in DVOA in rushing, and as a result of those stats, Sam Bradford is no longer the quarterback of the Cardinals. Can I give you some Sam Bradford stats?
Let's hear it.
He has a league worst minus 260 DR yards above replacement, but in this case below replacement through the first three games. He's averaging just 8.0 yards per completion. The only quarterback who's worse in the NFL, you guessed it. I referenced it earlier. It's Andrew Luck is averaging fewer.
Really?
Yards per completion. Yes.
Oh, doesn't. Yards per completion. Okay. His DR is better.
Yeah, that's why he said the Bradford had a league worst minus 260. That's what that means. 5% interception rate. Only Sam Darnold is worse there. So, again, all of that helps explain why they brought in Josh Rosen in the fourth quarter of a one-score game.
That was amazing.
In Chicago,
Well, honestly, like, look, both of those quarterbacks you're talking about had a person come in at the end of a one-score game.
Andrew Luck?
Yeah, because Jacoby Brissett came on.
That's still not the same. He wasn't like benched because of performance. He was benched because his arm literally isn't strong enough to make that throw. That one throw. There's not really a lot of decision making out of Hail Mary.
There's still people who think he's better than Russell.
There are not. Are there?
Oh, I'm sure there are. They're out there.
I feel like Colts fans are off the wagon at this point. Anyways, Josh Rosen, after coming in, went 4 of 7 for 36 yards with an interception. But that was enough to win him the starting job. One way that the Cardinals...
4 of 7 for 36 yards with an interception. But that was enough. You made it seem like he did. This was not Baker Mayfield coming out saving the game.
It wasn't. That's the joke. That's it.
Oh, my God.
One way the Cardinals could help out Josh Rosen or Sam Bradford or whoever is playing quarterback for them is by maybe trying to throw the ball to David Johnson beyond the line of scrimmage. He's averaging just 3.3 receptions per game so far, down from 5.0 in 2016, and 6.3 yards per catch, barely half of the 11 he averaged in 2016 before, of course, missing the final 15 games last season due to injury when he was on my fantasy team.
I was going to say, are you going to mention that? Okay.
Oh, obvious.
It haunts you forever.
Never not going to mention. I'm going to bring up the 2016
season. It's okay. I still hate DeAndre Hopkins for having a shitty year 2 years ago and then getting amazing the year after.
I mean, I don't hold it against these players.
But... Well, I hold it against Amari Cooper last year also.
Did have a 21-yard touchdown catch last Sunday against Chicago, but his other three catches in that game went for a combined 9 yards, and he has only one target this season while lined up as a wide receiver.
David Johnson, to me, is... I mean, first off, Bruce Arians was an excellent coach.
Yes.
Like, Bruce Arians... I mean, even the years when the Cardinals were probably bad, he managed to get that team a lot of times to, like, 7-9.
Yes.
Right? They were 7-9 last year, miraculously.
I don't know if I'd call it a miracle what happened between the Seahawks and the Cardinals on the last day of the season, but yes. That's not how I'd describe it.
Oh, my God.
the Blair Walsh miracle.
But the team had no business being a 7-9 team.
Yes.
They were a 4-12 team that Bruce Arians put on his shoulders to 7-9. He is an excellent
and also
coach.
I think the defensive coaching staff. Let's give a lot of credit. They've had strong defensive coordinators last year. I believe James Betcher. I think.
Is he still there?
He is not still there.
Everybody's gone. And that to me is honestly, when we were talking about the Seahawks and we were talking about process, it's like and what they're going that they're just not going to have good process offensively. What Bruce Arians was able to do with David Johnson is so impressive. And it's something that's not replicable for somebody like Steve Wilkes. He was the Panthers defensive coordinator,
yes,
right?
I don't think it's actually running the offense.
You know what, but to me, is like the one thing that I've learned from the last week of watching Pete Carroll is it's a very recent thing that I've learned. You should never put defensive coaches in charge of a football team. Because defensive coaches are so incapable of understanding what makes a good offense.
Which is weird because you should know what's hard for you to play against. And
they
Pete
don't.
Carroll often talks about things that are hard to play against. And it's successful offenses. And it just...
I mean, I don't understand how you don't look around. Like, why coaches aren't looking around the league and being like, hey, this Rams thing seems to be working. And then copying it exactly!
It was one of the mysteries of the offseason to me that nobody tried to hire a Sean McVay type. It seemed exactly like what
I mean,
was
I'm not going
to
say
there it didn't even happen on Ballers.
That many Sean McVay types.
It didn't even happen on Ballers on HBO because of the fact that they sent Charles Green to the Rams instead.
I'm sure that Charles Green wants to establish the run also.
By the way, Ballers on HBO. Just really, really.
We can't even
we don't
do after Ballers.
You haven't even watched it, but it's so bad.
But do you understand what I'm saying? Is that
yes?
Having a good offensive mind paired with, I just, what the Rams have going.
I mean, it may not be replicable, but
eventually the only thing that is going to catch up with the Rams is the salary cap.
Yes,
because eventually they're going to have to pay Jared Goff. They're going. Jared Goff is probably like.
Unless they just let Jared Goff go.
They're not going to let Jared Goff go.
Put any quarterback in this system.
Teams just don't think of it that way. Jared Goff is probably the 20th best quarterback in the NFL. And he's going,
he's going
to be paying like a top five quarterback.
I think he's been 12th to 15th.
Okay. Jared Goff might have been 12th to 15th, but he's going to be paid like a top five quarterback. Yes,
we can agree on that.
So.
Anyways, David Johnson also...
Why don't you just try to replicate things? I don't care about David Johnson. When you see... Okay, let's say I do care about David Johnson because this is emblematic of the problem with NFL coaches. If you are Steve Wilkes or whoever the hell their offensive coordinator is, why don't you say, let me just look at what Bruce Arians did with David Johnson 2 years ago. And maybe David Johnson is hurt. Like, maybe he hasn't fully recovered. Physically, no, he's not in the same place.
He's being used very differently.
You saw there was a tweet after week one of the charting of his offensive routes, right?
Yes.
Of his pass routes. And it was just like he's a shell of what he used to be because the offense is holding him back. Why? Your offense is so dumb.
By the way, Mike McCoy is the Arizona offense.
Oh, my God.
Mike McCoy.
I actually secretly kind of liked Mike McCoy.
He wasn't terrible. David Johnson also has not been successful as a runner this season.
Nobody's been successful as a runner this season.
On just 35% of his rushes so far per Football Outsiders. For comparison, Chris Carson is at 42% successful rushes thus far.
Really?
He has no carry.
A toast to Chris Carson.
Yeah. No carry longer than 11 yards all season for David Johnson. In fact, do you want to guess who has the longest Arizona Cardinals run this year?
Oh, my God. Sam Bradford?
Close.
Josh Rosen?
Josh Rosen, during his one quarter of play, had a 12-yard scramble. Oh, that is the longest
now
rush.
Now I'm scared about Chosen Rosen scrambling.
For the Arizona Cardinals. Larry Fitzgerald down from 6.8 receptions per game to 4.0 so far this season. Rookie Christian Kirk has probably been the Cardinals' most effective receiver.
Bruce Arians extended Larry Fitzgerald's career by like 6 years also.
I mean, here's the thing, actually, is that like he got a lot of catches, but his like per catch stats are no different. Like, they weren't that good before either.
Sure.
You didn't hear
that. They're just not completing a lot of passes anymore.
No, they are completing passes. They're just not gaining yards on those passes.
Great moments in
PPR
PPR history.
We really need that segment. That 14 catches from Adam Thielen last week.
Yeah, 14.
Outstanding.
Still lost. Okay, what about rookie Christian Kirk?
He's been their most second round pick. He's been their most effective receiver so far.
Can I guess where he went to college?
All right.
Texas A&M.
That is correct.
There we go.
Well done.
Crushing it.
All right, defensively, the Cardinals, they've been more effective defensively, but middle of the pack, down from where they were last year, under the aforementioned James Betcher, who is now the Giants defensive coordinator. They rank 14th overall in
DVOA. The Giants
DVOA,
are maybe sneaky good.
18th in covering against passing, 11th against rushing. They have struggled to cover anyone but outside receivers. Running backs are averaging 69 yards per receiving per game against them, the third highest total in the NFL. This has led to the benching of Deon Buchanan, the Washington State product, as well as 2017 first-round pick Hassan Reddick. The two of them played a combined 5 snaps on Sunday, much to dismay of Cardinals fans. They've been playing a lot of dime in passing situations instead of having Deon Buchanan out there as, you know, seemingly the hybrid linebacker safety that he was drafted to be. So good luck with that.
You know, it's probably Deon Buchanan's fault and not their coaching staff's fault.
They have generated a lot of successful pressure by committee. 2 sacks each so far for Chandler Jones, former Seahawks training camper, Benson Mayo.
On the team, right?
Was he?
He was never. He had to have played some snaps.
And Robert
Benson Mayo was on the team.
He wasn't cut before training camp.
No,
or at the end of training camp. I don't remember.
I wouldn't love Benson Mayo as. Actually, maybe I would.
Yeah, you fall in love with players during the preseason, not during the regular season. No one cares about the regular season. He did, in fact, play 2 games for the Seahawks in 2013.
Still love Thomas Rawls.
Better call Rawls. The Cardinals special team is ranked 21st. They have the league's third worst punting so far, have given up an average of 18.7 yards per return, including a 60-yarder to JoJo Natson of the Rams, who is a football player, apparently.
Everything is working for the Rams right now. They're having one of those seasons.
They have returned just 3 kickoffs this year for a long of 19 yards. So perhaps a week for the Seahawks to employ the strategy of kicking short with drop Sebastian Janikowski.
Yeah, we both got pretty excited about that one.
Oh, it's a good drop kick. It's weird that I said all that. By the way, it's kind of troubling. I said all that. The Seahawks are still only favored by 3 points in this game. I know it's on the road, but the Cardinals are really bad.
Three feels a little bit low, considering that the Cardinals are so far probably the worst team in the league. This is the first ever start for Josh Rosen going against what is a good defense that's actually created some pressure this year. I mean, that was one of our concerns going into the season, and the Seahawks have done a pretty good job of it, even without Tom Johnson. Frank Clark's having a good season. Like, I think they will be in Josh Rosen's face.
This doesn't seem like the place where you'd want Josh Rosen to make his first start against.
It's not
even a lesser Seahawks
defense. Exactly. It's not the Seahawks of yore or whatever, where you probably would
Earl
definitely
Thomas
not want that to happen.
Presumably is walking through that door.
You never actually know. But
Bobby Wagner.
Earl Thomas could be walking through that door.
He's likely walking through that. Bobby Wagner is walking through that door.
Hopefully. You never know with the Seahawks defense. Mm. Things have been pretty rough. But Shaquille Griffin is walking through that door. Bradley McDougald is walking through that door. Because this is a new face of a Seahawks defense, and they've been pretty stout so far this year. David Johnson doesn't really scare me.
I read a good piece about Bradley McDougald's season on The Athletic. I can't remember who wrote it.
I think it was Michael Scott Duggar.
No, it was Ben Bean. That was the joke.
Oh, did he write it?
And it's Mike Sean, by the way.
delete that. Just go ahead and delete that. Ben wrote a thing about Bradley McDougald.
He did.
I sure need to subscribe to that Athletic.
He's so prolific.
He's great, though. We were talking about Bradley McDougald, right?
Yes.
Being prolific.
being the reason you want to sign up for that.
Anyway, they're walking through that door. And this is a pretty good defense. Trey Flowers, by the way.
We haven't said much about Trey Flowers, and that's a good thing for a rookie cornerback.
Same with Ken Norton.
Yep.
This is a good defense going against a quarterback playing his first game in an offense that's anemic. There's just not a lot to scare me. Worst case scenario to me, the Seahawks don't score a ton of points. Honestly, realistically, the Seahawks are probably just won't score a ton of points.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't score a ton of points last week.
This could be a 17-6 type game, 21-15 type game. But, I mean, Arizona just does not have the offensive firepower to really hang in there with a Seahawks team that hypothetically could put together 2 or 3 drives.
I know the danger of optimism, but I feel optimistic about this game. I'm going to go like 65%.
Are you actually going to watch this one?
What do you mean?
Well, you missed the first 2 games.
Was it like because of the fact that I was upset about the Seahawks? And I didn't even miss the second game. I watched it all.
Are we watching this game together?
I think this is the first game we'll watch together.
A real
season.
Sunday. What were you giving percentage chances?
65.
I honestly think it's a little bit higher. I mean, they're playing what is probably the worst team in the league with no real answers. Like,
really horrible when you play this back next week after the Seahawks lose.
I mean, whatever. Like, if they do lose, I hope it's the catalyst for change.
Okay.
So, I still think they're not going to, though. I mean, realistically, they have an 80% chance of winning this game.
80%? Wow. In a game that
Arizona is
by 3 points, you should be betting the house on the Seahawks. Not literally. Then we'd have no place to record this podcast.
I don't know if it's quite legal yet. but I mean, this is a team that's worse. They're undervaluing the Seahawks in this game with that 3-point spread.
Hope so.
I mean, if you look at DVOA, you're talking about the number 14 team versus the number 31 team.
Correct.
And that's a favorable number 31 for the Cardinals.
Generous number 31. Right?
I mean, the team that's behind them just destroyed the Vikings in their house last week.
It is accurate.
The Cardinals have not beaten anybody, and they definitely have not beaten a team that was in the NFC Championship game last year.
The counter argument to all of this, by the way, is that the Seahawks lost to the Bears, granted on the road in a reasonably close.
The Bears are 2-1. Where do the Bears rank in DVOA?
Yeah, but the point was the Bears just barely beat the Cardinals in Arizona. They wouldn't have covered a 3-point spread.
Where do the Bears rank in DVOA?
I believe they're ranked 10th off the top of my head.
10th? Also, I don't think the Vikings did go to the NFC Championship game, right?
No, they did.
Okay, they lost to the Eagles in the championship game.
Yeah, they had the miraculous catch.
Okay.
You'll recall?
Yeah.
To beat the Saints. Yeah, the Bears are 10th. But they won by 2 points. That doesn't really serve to prove your point.
I know. I guess you're right about that.
So I think you're a little too optimistic. I think you need to regress your... It's amazing the emotional, wide emotional swings during the Seahawks segment.
This is an anti-Cardinals take, not a pro-Seahawks take, for the record here.
Fair.
I'm sticking with 80%.
All right. Anything else on this? On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thank you.